Well, first, thank you so much for coming. I believe that this is a record crowd for First Monday. As you may recall, classes started at the law school just about a week ago. So this would be a good time for you to come visit and have a look at the place. I don't think in my years at Chicago I have ever been so energized and positive about the law school as I am at this moment. I feel like bottling it. We have three new faculty who joined us this year, and they are starting off on a tear and doing great work. And students seem happy to be back, if that's even possible to imagine. Our massive renovation project is probably 85 or 90% done at this point, and the building seems once again habitable and pretty. And yet not over the top. I mean, it remains a place about ideas and about being student-centered. And if you had any doubts about your experiences at Chicago and you didn't think it was warm enough or the food was free enough, then come back, because we've solved those two problems. Classes remain as terrific as ever, and as you know, but I tell you every time I see you, you must visit, and just go into a class and visit. You don't need to get permission. Just sit in on class. As for speaking up in class, I leave that up to your discretion. Some of you have experience with sitting in the back and laying low, and I would recommend that you continue that that pattern. And I suspect that when he was in law school, our own Jeff Stone never sat in the back and kept quiet, though I don't really know. And maybe we'll find out about that. So this is our tradition of hearing, on what better day of the year could we hear about the coming Supreme Court term, and also about those who sit in those important seats. And Jeff will speak, I think, about 20 minutes, and then we'll hope to have energetic questions and answers. And I encourage you to speak up and enjoy the program, and I look forward to seeing you soon. So please help me in welcoming Jeff Stone.
I'm delighted to be here this afternoon to see so many familiar faces, so many friends, both personally and friends at the law school. I want to second what Saul said about the state of the law school these days. It really is quite wonderful, both from the standpoint of faculty and from the standpoint of students. It is intellectually, pedagogically, interesting, lively, challenging, exciting place, and you'd be very proud if you take the opportunity to come and spend some time there, that you will see it is the best of American higher education, the best of legal education, and Saul deserves a lot of credit for the leadership that's brought us to that point. I did not sit in the back when I was a student. I sat in the middle to be even less conspicuous. I did not volunteer often in class, but I will, since Saul raised the subject, tell you briefly a story about when I was a first-year law student. When I first arrived at law school in 1968, the terror of the first year was Jeff Hazard. Some of you will remember Jeff, who taught Civil Procedure 1, and he was a aggressive, nasty, mean-spirited Socratic teacher who had a reputation for leaving students weeping when he was done with them. In fact, this was true. And the day before classes began, I was sitting up in the library with a fellow first-year student, and we didn't really know where we were or who was around us, and this young guy comes along and he says, "Aha, I see the new crop has arrived." And thinking he was a second or third-year student, I said, "Screw off, buddy." At which point I turned back to my friend, Elliot, and he said, "That was Jeff Hazard." Which is true. And I spent that entire quarter in absolute terror. And what Hazard did, he would go down the row and he would skip me. And he would go up the rows and he would skip me. And years later, when I ran into him, maybe 15 years later, I said, he was then Jeff, I said, "Jeff, do you happen to remember when I was a first year law student?" And he laughed and he said, "You mean the way I skipped you all the time?" So he was completely aware of what he was doing, son of a bitch. So in this first Monday talk, my task, assigned to me by no less an authority than Dean Levmore, is to offer some hopefully interesting and perhaps even provocative thoughts about the Supreme Court of the United States. And I intend to express my own vexation, disappointment, annoyance, and frustration. And I trust that I will succeed in expressing those views. Now, in law school, of course, we teach that the law is a ruthlessly rational discipline, devoid of any emotion. That, of course, is a lie. But it's a useful lie. We lie to our law students because in order to learn to think like lawyers, they must develop the capacity to argue with cool, clear, and calculating reason. They must learn to put their emotions aside and to use their powers of unsentimental, hard-edged, razor-steel reasoning in order to define and illuminate their arguments and their analyses. So we law professors are right to employ this little deceit, because without the capacity to reason in a brutally Posnerian, Sunsteinian, Epsteinian manner, a lawyer would be of no use to anyone. But truth be known, the law is not only about hard-edged, analytical, purebred logic, it is also quite fundamentally about values. And although in law school we underscore the power of reason, we secretly do hope that our students will never forget that their responsibility as lawyers is to use the power of reason to further certain values, the values of individual liberty, human dignity, justice, and equality. Properly understood, these are neither liberal nor conservative values in any partisan or ideological sense. They are rather our constitutional values, the values to which all lawyers should be committed. Their responsibility, your responsibility, is to preserve and to protect those values, and to do so with passion and at times even with emotion, but always in a way that is intellectually honest, analytically rigorous, and closely reasoned. Now, my thesis this afternoon is this. The current majority of the Supreme Court of the United States, and particularly Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito, are failing not only to preserve and protect fundamental constitutional values, but also to fulfill their judicial responsibilities in a manner that is analytically rigorous, closely reasoned, and intellectually honest. These are strong words. This is not a talk for the faint of heart. At the core of my thesis is the principle of stare decisis. Most of you probably knew relatively little about stare decisis before you entered law school. But before too long, you were no doubt masters of the art. The doctrine of precedent is, of course, central to our legal system. It is based not on the assumption that prior judges are smarter than their successors, but rather on the need for consistency, efficiency, and predictability, and on the need not to overly politicize the judicial process and thereby undermine and destroy its credibility. Now, of course, as you well know, to say that precedent is supposed to govern isn't really to say very much. Not only are there circumstances in which a court is justified in overruling a prior decision, but courts, in fact, have considerable latitude in interpreting prior decisions more or less broadly or narrowly. Every law student learns early on that the art of distinguishing and reconciling precedents invites a sometimes stunning degree of legal creativity. But for the judicial process to have integrity, that creativity must be bounded by intellectual honesty. It is not intellectually honest, for example, to distinguish a prior decision on the ground that it was handed down on a Tuesday rather than on a Wednesday, or on the ground that the car was blue rather than green. Moreover, because the act of overruling a prior decision is and should be relatively unusual in our legal system, such an act, when it does occur, should be openly acknowledged, explained, and justified. Now, I first began to learn about all this myself in Elements of the Law in the fall of 1968 when I was a first-year student at the law school. Elements was then taught, as some of you will remember, by Professor Sawyer Menchikoff. Menchikoff was a brilliant lawyer who drilled into her students both the potential for interpretive creativity and the necessity for intellectual integrity. Two of the required books in my Elements of the Law course were Carl Llewellyn's The Bramblebush and Edward Levy's Introduction to Legal Reasoning. Llewellyn and Levy, by the way,
had both taught elements of the law in Chicago. In preparation for this talk, I went back to my dog-eared copies of those two works to see whether I had remembered correctly what I thought I'd learned from Llewellyn, Levy, and Menchikoff almost 40 years ago. Sure enough, Llewellyn expressly referred in the Bramblebush to the ethical element in the doctrine of precedent, which he defined as the principle that courts should presumptively continue what they have been doing. He characterized this principle as fundamental to the judicial conscience. As an illustration of disingenuous judicial behavior, Llewellyn offered the example of a court distinguishing a prior decision by declaring, I quote, "This rule holds only of red-headed Walpoles in pale magenta Buick cars." With biting sarcasm, Llewellyn added that when you find this said of a past case, you know that in effect it has been overruled. For his part, Edward Levy wrote that the basic pattern of legal reasoning is a three-step process described by the doctrine of precedent, in which a proposition descriptive of the first case is made into a rule of law and then applied to a next similar situation. The steps, he said, are these. Similarity is seen between cases. Next, the rule of law inherent in the first case is announced. Then the rule of law is made applicable to the second case. At the heart of the process, Levy emphasized, is the determination of similarity or difference between the two cases. Now, of course, the question of similarity or difference is one of judgment. The interpretation and application of precedent is not a mechanical or an automatic process. And reasonable people can and do differ about how broadly or narrowly a prior decision should be construed. Many factors can quite legitimately shape that judgment, including not only the responsibility to attempt to identify a neutral or objective understanding of the precedent, but also differing perspectives on the wisdom of the prior decision and on the wisdom of applying it to the new situation. As Levy wrote, legal reasoning has a logic of its own. Its structure fits it to give meaning to ambiguity and to test constantly whether the society has come to see new differences or new similarities. But despite the subtleties inherent in the use of precedent, underlying it must be a commitment to judicial integrity. It is the responsibility of the judge faithfully to apply precedent, to explain his or her reasoning in an honest and forthright manner, to acknowledge the difficulties when they arise, and to explain and to justify any departures from precedent. That is at the very heart of the judicial craft, and it is the very essence of a principled system of law. In their Senate confirmation hearings, John Roberts and Samuel Alito cast themselves as first-rate lawyers committed to the rule of law, and especially to the principle of stare decisis. Roberts assured the Senate that judges must be bound down by rules and precedents. He explained that the framers of the Constitution appreciated the role of precedent in promoting even-handedness, predictability, stability, and integrity in the judicial process. Although acknowledging that it is sometimes necessary for judges to reconsider precedents, he emphasized that this should be reserved for exceptional circumstances. A sound judicial philosophy, Roberts reasoned, must recognize that judges work within a system of rules developed over the years by other judges, equally striving to live up to the judicial oath. Similarly, Samuel Alito testified that stare decisis is a fundamental part of our legal system. He maintained that this principle limits the power of the judiciary and ensures that judges will respect the judgments and the wisdom that are embodied in prior judicial decisions. Stare decisis, he added, is not an inexorable command, but there must be a strong presumption that courts are going to follow precedents. It's hardly surprising that Roberts and Alito would pay such homage to stare decisis in their confirmation hearings. Stare decisis is a bedrock principle of the rule of law, and no nominee who expressed disdain for this principle would ever be confirmed. Now, based largely on his quite convincing statements about the rule of law in his confirmation hearings, I publicly supported the confirmation of John Roberts. I wrote in an op-ed in the Chicago Tribune that, quote, "Roberts is too good a lawyer, too good a craftsman to embrace a disingenuous approach to constitutional interpretation. Everything about him suggests a principled, pragmatic judge who will act cautiously and with a healthy respect for precedent." Those are words I now sadly am quite prepared to eat.
Disappointingly, it's apparent to me that Justice Roberts and Samuel Alito's conduct during the court's 2006 term speaks much louder than their words to Congress. In case after case, Roberts and Alito repeatedly abandoned the principle of stare decisis and did so in a particularly insidious manner. Indeed, in a manner that brought forth the scorn not only of the so-called liberals on the court, but even of Justices Scalia and Thomas. Their technique, that is Roberts and Alito's technique, which was perfectly described and ridiculed by Carl Llewellyn, is to purport to respect the president, while in fact cynically interpreting it into oblivion. Every first-year law student knows the tactic. Appellant argues that Smith versus Jones governs the case before us, but Smith versus Jones arose out of an incident that occurred on Main Street. The event in this case occurred on State Street. We do not overrule Smith versus Jones, but we limit it to events that occur on Main Street. Although this is a parody of the technique of distinguishing a precedent, it captures the spirit of the Roberts-Alito concept of the judicial craft. Let me offer five concrete examples. First, in Gonzales versus Carhart, the court, in a 5-4 decision, upheld the constitutionality of a federal law prohibiting so-called partial birth abortion, even though the court had held a virtually identical state law unconstitutional 7 years earlier. As Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg rightly observed in dissent, the majority, which included Justices Roberts, Alito, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, offered no principled basis for ignoring the earlier decision. The only difference was that Alito had replaced O'Connor. Second, in Federal Election Commission versus Wisconsin Right to Life, the same five-justice majority held unconstitutional a provision of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act that limited political expenditures by corporations, even though the court had upheld the exact same provision only 4 years earlier. And as Justice David Souter accurately observed in his dissent, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion offered no principled basis for distinguishing the earlier decision. Third, in Hind versus Freedom from Religion Foundation, the same five-justice majority, an opinion by Justice Alito, held that individual taxpayers have no standing to challenge the constitutionality of the Bush administration's program of faith-based initiatives as violative of the Establishment Clause, even though the court had held some 40 years ago that taxpayers do have standing to challenge federal expenditures on precisely these grounds. As Justice Souter rightly observed in dissent, Alito's argument that the earlier decision, Flast versus Cohn, was distinguishable because it involved a challenge to a legislative rather than an executive branch program had no basis in either logic or precedent. Fourth, in Morris versus Frederick, the same five-justice majority, in an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, held that a high school student could constitutionally be suspended for displaying a banner bearing the message "Bong Hits for Jesus" during a school event, even though there was no evidence that the speech had materially or substantially disrupted school activities, and even though the court had held in the Tinker case 40 years earlier that a student cannot constitutionally be disciplined for otherwise constitutionally protected speech unless it materially and substantially disrupts school activities. Chief Justice Roberts purported to distinguish Tinker on the ground that Frederick's speech could be interpreted as encouraging unlawful conduct. But as those of you who might recall Tinker will remember, the wearing of black armbands to protest the Vietnam War could just as readily have been interpreted as encouraging other students to refuse induction into the Army or to participate in unlawful acts of protest. It was, again, a distinction utterly without a difference. Finally, in Parents Involved in Community Schools versus Seattle, the same five-justice majority, in an opinion again by Chief Justice Roberts, held that the consideration of race by school districts in assigning students to public schools in order to increase racial diversity violates the Equal Protection Clause, even though the court unanimously declared more than 35 years ago that such a policy is within the broad discretionary authority of school authorities, and even though the court had held only 4 years ago in Grutter versus Bollinger that public universities can take race into account in the much more problematic context of affirmative action. As Justice Breyer rightly asked in dissent, what has happened to stare decisis? Adding insult to injury, Roberts had the audacity to cite Brown versus the Board of Education as precedent for his conclusion. Brown, of course, had held that government cannot constitutionally assign black and white students to different schools in order to segregate them. Incredibly, Roberts invoked Brown as authority for the proposition that government cannot constitutionally assign black and white students to the same school in order to integrate them. Roberts' invocation of Brown for this proposition displayed what can only be described as willful ignorance of American history. Let me read you the critical passage from Brown. "We come then to the question presented. Does segregation of children in public schools on the basis of race deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does. To separate them from others of similar age and qualification solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. Segregation of white and colored children in public schools is usually interpreted as denoting the inferiority of the Negro group, and a sense of inferiority affects the motivation of a child to learn. We conclude that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal, and that the racial segregation of black and white children deprives the black children of the equal protection of the laws." To cite Brown versus the Board of Education as authority for the proposition that the Constitution forbids the use of race to promote a more integrated society is profoundly dishonest. At the risk of overkill, let me also read you an excerpt from Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, which captures perfectly, I think, what Brown was really all about. "We have waited," King wrote, "for more than 340 years for our rights. Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the sting of segregation to say wait, but when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers, when you've seen hate-filled policemen curse and kick your black brothers and sisters, when you see the vast majority of your Negro brothers smothering in a cage of poverty, when you find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park and see tears welling up in her eyes when she is told that it is closed to colored children and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her mental sky, when you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in your automobile because no motel will accept you, when you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored, when your first name becomes nigger, your middle name becomes boy, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title Mrs., when you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait." Is this ancient history? Perhaps, but even if it is the history that is critical to understanding Brown and the Board of Education. Moreover, this is not quite so ancient history. In the United States today, white children are twice as likely as black children to grow up in a two-parent family. White SAT scores are more than 200 points higher than black SAT scores. White family income is almost double black family income. Blacks are 10 times more likely than whites to be in prison. Blacks are twice as likely as whites to be unemployed and twice as likely as whites to live below the poverty line. For Chief Justice Roberts to assert that Brown versus the Board of Education stands for the proposition that the Constitution prohibits the government from using race in an effort to redress such inequalities is insulting. Now let me be clear. My point is not that the substantive positions of Roberts and Alito in these cases are necessarily unsupportable as a matter of first principles. To the contrary, each of the substantive positions that they advance in these cases is plausible if they were writing on a clean slate. Indeed, if they were writing on a clean slate, I might even agree with one or two of them. But they were not writing on a clean slate. They were writing within the context of the American legal system and the American legal tradition. And I have no doubt that a neutral and detached lawyer, given the relevant precedent and the issue presented in each of these cases, would in each instance conclude that the clearly right result as a matter of legal reasoning is opposite to the result reached by Justices Roberts and Alito. In these circumstances, Roberts and Alito had a responsibility either to comply with the law or, as Scalia and Thomas rightly argued, to overrule the precedent and take responsibility for their actions. What they did and said was not sloppy or careless, it was dishonest. Now, why would they do this? In each of these cases, Roberts and Alito had three choices. They could overrule the prior decision, they could follow the prior decision and reach the opposite result, or they could do what they did. Overruling these precedents would have made apparent that their testimony in their confirmation hearings was, to be generous, misleading. So then, why didn't they just abide by the precedents? One possibility, I suppose, is that their overriding commitment to some deeply principled constitutional theory drove them to reach the results they did in these cases, even at the expense of intellectual honesty. But in fact, there is no such theory. For example, one might imagine that Roberts and Alito are committed to a modest judicial role, to a humble form of strict construction that rejects any semblance of judicial activism as a legitimate style of constitutional interpretation. Unfortunately, that theory does not fit the facts, for at least two of the five decisions I've mentioned evidenced a quite aggressive form of judicial activism. In both Wisconsin Right to Life, the campaign finance case, and the Seattle and Louisville cases involving the use of race, Roberts and Alito exercised a highly activist form of judicial review in order to invalidate laws under the First and 14th Amendments, respectively. Similarly, these decisions cannot plausibly be explained on the basis of originalism, for nothing in the original understanding of the Constitution, however interpreted, rationally supports Roberts and Alito's votes in Wisconsin Right to Life or the Seattle and Louisville cases. The truth is that Roberts and Alito were driven by nothing more than their own desire to reach results that they prefer. They don't like abortion. They don't like speech that mocks Jesus. They don't like laws that regulate corporate speech. They don't like affirmative action, and they don't like faith-based, and they do like faith-based initiatives. If ever such phrases as result-oriented and ideologically driven ring true, it's in the conduct of Justices Roberts and Alito during the 2006 term. It was among the most disgraceful judicial performances I have ever witnessed. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions or comments. So the question is, how much deference should be given to a decision that was made without reference to stare decisis? I don't think that justices should be in the business, simply as a matter of sound judging, of assessing the legitimacy of particular precedents on the basis of the next generation judge's view of how much respect the prior judges gave to the precedent of the prior judges. I think they should basically accord weight to precedent to the extent they believe the precedent reflects, in fact, a sound interpretation of the Constitution, and the extent to which they feel that overruling it would unduly disrupt or interfere with the overall system of law. So I guess the answer is I don't think that much weight should be given to the fact that a current court thinks a prior decision didn't give much weight to a prior precedent. I think they should ask whether they think the prior decision is right on the merits of the meaning of the Constitution. And to the extent they think it's wrong, they then should address the question of whether it should be overruled or how it should be interpreted. But I think I probably wouldn't think of the role of the justices as grading each other's respect for precedent as a way of deciding whether to give weight to prior decisions. There's no particularly principled reason why that's a bad idea. I think there's enough things that judges have to try to do to make sense out of the law that adding that additional twist probably wouldn't be a terribly useful matter. I'd much rather have them focus on the question of what does the precedent mean, what does it tell us about the current dispute, and is there some legitimate reason why we should question the value or weight of the precedent, which would really go back to the correct meaning of the Constitution, whatever that means, rather than the particulars of whether the justices who decided the case did it well or badly from the standpoint of craftsmanship. So the question is right, having explained to Roberts and Alito that they did not undertake their responsibilities admirably this past year, will they now and have they now changed their tune? Well, first of all, the 2007 term just begins, so we will see. Second of all, I have absolutely no reason to believe that they are in any way, shape, or form aware of my criticisms. On the other hand, I'm not the only one to have made these criticisms, and I'm quite sure they're aware that their performance in the 2006 term has been subject by a range of people to this critique. You know, when I gave this talk in DC a couple of weeks ago, I had a different conclusion. I ended with the line that, well, we'll see what happens in 2007. I am basically an optimist. And I got skewered by several people in the audience for that. And I am an optimist, but there's such a thing as being a stupid optimist. And on reflection, I concluded that their criticisms of my being optimistic in this respect were probably well-founded. That I do think Roberts and Alito, like all justices, want to do their jobs well, want to be remembered as having performed their responsibilities well. I think they will be bothered by this kind of criticism. I actually do believe that both of them are quite good judicial craftsmen, and I think they behaved quite badly in this term. So I'm not so sure that they won't be more careful as they go forward, partly because I think they don't want to be criticized, and partly because I think they don't want to be remembered as judges who behaved badly. And I don't know either of them personally, so I don't have any idea what they're like as individuals. But most of the judges and justices I know want to do their jobs well. And I think in this instance they didn't, and I think they're smart enough to hear that criticism. And at least at the margin, this is my optimism creeping in again, at the margin, I would like to think that they will be thoughtful about this. In my experience with judges and justices, that almost without exception, with some exceptions, but almost without exception, they have really listened to criticism and tried to figure out whether they were doing things well or badly. So I still insist on being a bit of an optimist about this. But we'll see. Okay, so the question is whether I have a prediction about how the court will rule on the habeas corpus case that is pending for this term. The issue presented in the case is essentially as follows. One of the reasons, the reason, the administration located Guantanamo Bay at Guantanamo Bay was because it believed that in that location it would be outside the habeas corpus jurisdiction of the federal courts. And this is not speculation, this is clear from their own people in the administration having explained this. In fact, the Supreme Court held several years ago that under the then existing habeas corpus statute, that even though Guantanamo Bay is not part of the territorial limits of the United States, it is part of the relevant sovereignty of the United States for purposes of the habeas corpus statute, and therefore the individuals detained at Guantanamo Bay could bring habeas corpus actions in federal court to challenge the legality of their detentions. Thereafter, in 2006, right before the new Congress took over, the Republican-led Congress enacted legislation that rewrote the habeas corpus statute of the United States specifically to provide that it does not give jurisdiction to federal courts to hear habeas corpus actions filed by the individuals detained at Guantanamo. And the question now posed in the case pending before the court is whether it is constitutional for the Congress to withdraw habeas corpus jurisdiction for individuals who were located in Guantanamo Bay. And that constitutional question, in turn, is framed as follows. The Constitution provides that the writ of habeas corpus may not be suspended except in cases of invasion or insurrection and rebellion, and even then only when the public safety so requires. And clearly, those conditions are not satisfied. So if the constitutional right of habeas corpus applies, it could not constitutionally be suspended by either president or the Congress in these circumstances. But the argument is that the constitutional right of habeas corpus does not reach beyond the boundaries of the United States. And that even though the original habeas corpus statute was interpreted by the court to reach Guantanamo, that the constitutional guarantee of habeas corpus does not reach Guantanamo, and that therefore federal courts have no jurisdiction since the statute no longer gives it to them and the Constitution does not require that they be given that jurisdiction. So that's the question before the Supreme Court. It's pretty probable that 8 of the 9 votes are predictable based upon prior positions that the justices have taken on these issues since 2004, or that Alito and Roberts have taken on courts of appeals before they were on the Supreme Court. As in so many of these issues, the swing vote then comes to Justice Kennedy. Kennedy has tended to be pretty critical of the Bush administration in the war on terror cases that the court has decided. And I think the kind of conventional prediction wisdom, to which I have really nothing to add, is that Kennedy is more likely than not to vote to hold unconstitutional the withdrawal of habeas jurisdiction from Guantanamo. But, you know, it's kind of a crapshoot when you're predicting an individual justice on a case where there's no compelling precedent on either side of the question. Right, so this is, the question is, to what extent have Roberts and Alito behaved the way I've described, in part because they need to accommodate Kennedy? And they need the fifth vote, and Kennedy is not prepared to go the route of Scalia and Thomas by directly overruling these decisions. Roberts and Alito don't want to leave Kennedy out there on his own as a sort of free-floating fifth vote. So in order to be effective within the court, they're prepared to sign on to opinions that they themselves might not have much respect for, but it's a way of keeping Kennedy in the fold. That's possible. I mean, it's one of the perfectly plausible interpretations of their behavior. On the other hand, it's a little doubtful when you actually read the opinions themselves, because Alito and Roberts have each written separate concurring opinions in some of these cases, in which they've really nitpicked each other about the details of these issues. So my guess would be that it's a reasonable explanation that is what has affected them, because Kennedy has not been prepared to go the whole route, and that they have been trying to accommodate his interest. But it's also the case that they could have done this a whole lot better. And so I don't know what I think, frankly, about the legitimacy of attempting to accommodate the fifth vote in order to keep that vote on your side. Clearly, the practical realities of working within a court require you to figure out how to get a majority and to keep a majority, and that sometimes clearly requires the sacrifice of integrity in what you write. Because if the fifth justice doesn't want to join that sentence and a different fifth justice doesn't want to join another sentence, you have to write an opinion which actually doesn't satisfy anybody. It just avoids having sentences in it that alienate some of those five. So it is plausible that there's that explanation for the Roberts Alito conduct in this term, and I wouldn't rule that as out of the question. Okay, so the question is that there's a cert petition pending in a Second Amendment case, right, to keep him bare arms case out of the District of Columbia. Involved, I assume that's what you're referring to, right? Yeah, the D.C. Gun statute, which was held unconstitutional by the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and the question is, will the court deny cert in this, given the fact, in particular, that it's an election year? I don't think that it's an election year is likely to affect the justices very much on this issue. My guess is they will grant cert and that they will hold the statute unconstitutional. And again, this belies the notion, and this is a point I guess I really should underscore, is that when we talk about conservative justices and liberal or so-called liberal justices on the current court, it is important not to fall victim to the sort of political labeling that I think is very misleading. That is, when we think of conservative justices and the way that term came to be defined in the 1980s, what it sort of meant was judges who were very reluctant to reach out and use the judicial power to hold unconstitutional actions of the democratically elected branches of government. That is, they were passive judges. They believed in judicial restraint. They were kind of like Frankfurter. That was sort of the model that the critique of the Warren Court led political conservative figures to enunciate. That does not remotely describe the judicial conservatism of the current Supreme Court. In cases like the Seattle case, and like Wisconsin Right to Life, and like the Second Amendment case, these justices are extremely activist about interpreting the Constitution to hold unconstitutional laws that have been enacted by democratically elected branches of the government. They pursue the use of the judicial authority to serve a certain set of interests or values different from the ones that liberal judicial activists, for the most part, have been activist about. So traditionally, liberal judicial activists have invalidated laws that disadvantage minorities, that do not, in their view, adequately protect the interests of criminal defendants that distort the political process in ways that are thought to undermine a robust electoral system. Conservative justices, more recently, have tended to use the power of judicial review more actively to protect property rights, to protect the interests of corporations, to strike down affirmative action programs, to protect commercial advertising. So there's a very different set of values and interests to protect the right to keep and bear arms. But it is important, I think, to keep in mind that when we talk about conservatives now, we're not talking about the model of the restrained justice, which was what in the 80s people talked about. We're talking about people who were very aggressive about using the judicial power to invalidate laws for a certain set of values quite different from the ones that the Warren Court or some of the more liberal justices of the current court would use. So the fact that they, I believe, will invalidate the D.C. statute is simply another example of cases like the race case or the invalidation of the McCain-Feingold legislation of the use of activist judicial review to serve a conservative rather than the liberal constitutional agenda. So is there anything that can be done for the confirmation process that will prevent justices from misleading dupes like me? Yeah, we should expect a lot less of the confirmation process. I think the confirmation process has become a waste of everybody's time, and it probably should be scrapped completely, and we should go back to an era when questions are asked, if they're asked at all, only to the extent that there are real reasons to ask questions, but that certainly over the past 25 years, the culture has evolved in such a way so that nominees to the Supreme Court almost always have pretty strong records about who they are in general. And we know more than we need to know about their attitude about the roles of courts to and their qualifications and their intellectual abilities and so on to be able to make reasonable judgments about confirmation. So I would make the confirmation process much simpler, much more straightforward, not get involved in all these senators playing to the camera. And I do think, by the way, that the nominees are completely right in their reluctance to address questions about cases that might at some time come before them. I mean, that's often regarded by people in the media as a kind of disingenuous response, that they're just ducking the issue, they're trying to hide their attitudes from the public so they can sneak through. I think that's really wrong. I mean, I think that a nominee absolutely should not state in a confirmation proceeding what his or her view is on a matter that might come before the court. If they do that, if they state that, then they put themselves in an impossible position when the case actually comes before them. Because if they decide the case the way they said they would, then everyone will say they're simply now doing what they promised they would do. They've corrupted themselves by making a commitment to decide a case before they heard the case in a certain way. And if they decide the case in the opposite way, then of course they're going to be accused of having perjured themselves in the confirmation process. So I think that the process should be softened dramatically. I don't think that the problem that we have is with the overall quality of nominees or a lack of knowledge of who the nominees are in a way in which it's relevant for us to know who they are. I may have been deceived by Roberts in this particular respect, and maybe the reasons Roberts behaved the way he did are really much more understandable for institutional reasons, but in any event, I don't think that we need to delve into the attitudes and values of these justices anywhere near the way we have. I think it's been a waste of time. It's demeaned the court, it's demeaned the process, and I don't think it's added any value. Okay, the question is, can Roberts and Alito defend their use of Brown on the ground that Brown was dealing with a very different situation? He was dealing with the intentional segregation of whites and blacks who lived in the same community and sending them off to different schools. And whereas in the Seattle and Louisville cases, you had African American and white kids living for the most part in different residential communities where they were being assigned to schools that were not necessarily the most convenient ones to their homes. So let me answer that first. The answer to that is no, because my point was not that Brown dictates the result in this case. It was that they had no business citing Brown for the proposition that it supported the result in this case. I don't think Brown decides these cases at all. I think Brown clearly dealt with a different problem. The point is they had the audacity, in my view, to cite Brown as authority for the decision they reached in this case. That I believe to be completely disingenuous. But I agree Brown's a different case, and I wouldn't cite Brown if I were deciding the case the other way either. It doesn't tell you very much about this problem, one way or the other. That's my point. The second question is, could they defend their result on the ground that this was an originalist understanding of the Equal Protection Clause? And there I would say two things. First, remember, I suggested that if there was a clearly compelling justification for deciding a case inconsistently with what precedents might have suggested, that might be a legitimate justification to overrule the precedents and to decide the case the right way. But the right way to do that is to say that's what you're doing. That's what Scalia and Thomas were prepared to do. So I don't think that excuses the writing of an opinion that fails to address any of those questions. Beyond that, my own view is that as a matter of originalism, this is a completely unsupportable interpretation of the 14th Amendment. What originalism supposedly means, there are lots of different versions, of course, of originalism, but what it means in the voice of people like Scalia and Thomas and Bork and others is that we only invalidate those practices that the framers of a particular provision of the Constitution themselves affirmatively intended to invalidate when they adopted the provision. That is, it's adopting a very narrow view of judicial authority and saying we are merely agents of the framers and we invalidate only what they intended and expected to invalidate and nothing beyond that. Anything beyond that, we're just entering a world of so-called interpretation, which we don't think is legitimate. So I have two answers to that. First, I think that completely misunderstands the intent of the framers itself. It's an internally inconsistent analysis. The framers of almost all of the relevant provisions dealing with individual liberties were not, in fact, intending to adopt a provision that had that kind of crabbed, narrow meaning. That's why they didn't say, no state shall deny equal protection of the laws on the basis of race, for example, or to blacks, or whatever, or freedom of speech was not defined as a statute. They were adopting, and they knew they were adopting, open-ended principles that would evolve over time. There's absolutely no question they understood that's exactly what they were doing when they drafted these provisions. So the idea of attributing to them this very narrow understanding is just not, in fact, respecting what they actually wanted. What they wanted was for a much more difficult process to exist. Second point, I'll be done. Second point is that if you do try to understand the original intent of the drafters of the Equal Protection Clause, they certainly did not intend to invalidate programs designed to promote diversity or integration. That was not on the agenda at all. They had no view about that question, none whatsoever. And so if you're taking a narrow view of originalism, you simply can't make any judgment about that. There's not a word that was ever spoken during the debates on the 14th Amendment about this question. All the, quote, originalists are doing on this issue is attributing to the framers their view of what's a good racial policy in our society and assuming that since they think it's a good view, the framers must have held it well. But that's not originalism, right? So I don't think you could make a principled argument for that proposition. Thank you very much.